I wanted to just do a real quick review of where we've been the last 2 weeks, and then we'll get into new stuff. But if you recall, I'm sorry, it's hard to see that. But so just to kind of follow up where we were at, we first talked about how the Reformation first came to Scotland by Patrick Hamilton, you remember, who was martyred after 3 months of ministry, then George Wishart, who was also burned at the stake, and then finally John Knox, who really is kind of viewed as the father of Presbyterianism, if anyone is, and his struggle against Mary, Queen of Scots. And then we also looked at the time after that, when King James, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, comes to power, and his sort of clever, strategic way of changing the church from Presbyterianism back to prelacy. And we saw that struggle that occurred. When James dies, his son Charles becomes king. And remember, they said Charles was an earnest and stupid man. That's my favorite description of him. But he quickly, does what his father does, but does it just right out of the gate, bluntly, and introduces a whole new book of worship, a book of common prayer. There's the riot at St. Giles Cathedral. Remember the lady throwing her stool? That causes the revolution in Scotland and really the Second Reformation, which leads to the National Covenant and the Solemn League and Covenant and things like that. Just to highlight, the National Covenant again was signed by 300,000 people in a nation of 1 million, so a huge percent of the country signed it, and it really did reflect the will of the people, I think. The Solemn League and Covenant, though, I wanted to just spend a little bit more time. We had breezed through that last week, but wanted to just look at that a little bit more to understand why that wasn't as wise, maybe, as a covenant. So you have Scotland. They've sort of revolted and against Charles and said, we're going to have this Reformed church, whether you like it or not. Charles now is down in London. He's the king of all Great Britain. And he's frustrated, but Charles has ruled as a tyrant through all Great Britain. He hasn't allowed an English Parliament to meet in 10 years. It's him alone being the ruler, and so he wants to take an army up and sort of quash this rebellion in Scotland and stamp it out. But an army takes money, and money, the only way a government gets money is taxes. And the way English law was at the time, and it probably still is, the only body, the political body in England that could raise taxes, create new taxes, was Parliament. The king couldn't actually do that. He could do, taxes on exports and imports and things like that, but no, just kind of general tax. So Charles is faced with the dilemma, do I call a Parliament to pass these tax laws I need to go take an army up north, or do I, let Scotland do what it does? And remember, when you call a Parliament, just like our Congress, Parliament is sort of, each of their counties or areas, come together for an election, vote their member of Parliament, and he goes and represents them, just like our Congress. And so the problem is if the people, if the popular opinion is against you as a king, to call a Parliament's a dangerous thing, because, if the will of the people doesn't like Charles, well, the Parliament's not going to like Charles either. So that's the dilemma he has. He goes ahead and says, I'm going to call a Parliament. Does that, they come together, won't do what he says to do, he's frustrated, and he disbands it after 3 weeks. That's called the short parliament. He tries it again, this parliament comes together, won't do what he does, he tries to disband it, they don't disband, and the English Civil War starts, which is between Charles the King and the English Parliament. So he's sort of trying to stamp out this Scottish Reformation. He creates all these problems for himself in England, and eventually the English Civil War. So now you have this situation where you got Charles and his followers on one side, English Parliament and their followers on the other side fighting, and they're kind of evenly matched. And English Parliament goes up to Scotland and says, hey, let's enter into a treaty. You come and fight alongside us. You can help us take off, get rid of Charles, and you don't like Charles like we don't like Charles. Let's, this is a good thing. Scotland says, well, we don't want to do a political treaty, but we will do a religious covenant with you. And England says, whatever, we'll do it. And this covenant says, we will, as Ireland, England, and Scotland, as the parliaments of those three nations, we will, covenant together to preserve the church in Scotland as it is, because it's reformed, it's Presbyterian, and we'll work to reform the Church of England and reform the Church of Ireland. That's the Solemn League and Covenant. And so they agree to that, but that agreement was not, you know, England had no intention of ever keeping that, you know, or at least that's what history proved out. And so, you know, while the National Covenant really was this, you know, all of Scotland coming together saying this is the will of the people, the Solemn League and Covenant was sort of ulterior motives and things like that, and it kind of failed in what it was meant to do. So that's sort of the Solemn League and Covenant. Just to give you a quote, this is your first quote in your outline from J.D. Douglas. He says, "The alliance," talking about this Solemn League and Covenant, "was an unhappy one from the beginning, for the respective national causes differed radically. The ground of the Scottish quarrel with the king, after all superficialities had been cleared away, was religion. That of the English, essentially, the more mundane constitutional point of legal taxation. It would have been better if in 1643 two covenants had been drawn up, one dealing with civil and the other with religious affairs." So anyways, just wanted to point that out, kind of the differences between the National Covenant and the Solemn League and Covenant. Scotland is angry with England because they break the Solemn League and Covenant. They're also angry because after Scotland and the English Parliament defeat Charles, Charles is in the custody of the Scottish army. England says, send Charles to us. And Scotland says, well, we'll only send him to you if you promise not to kill him. England says, sure. Sends him down. They put him on trial, convict him, and execute him. So England kind of kept breaking their word to Scotland, and Scotland is frustrated with England. And you'll see how that comes into play later on today. So that's just sort of a review where we've been. That gets us up to this point of Charles I being executed, and then you have the time of Oliver Cromwell as Lord Protector. That was his title, and we'll get into that. But before we get there, what I want to look at first is to better understand this controversy between the King James, King Charles, King Charles, King James, and the Stuart dynasty on one side, who are the divine right of kings, that's their view, and then on the other side, the Scottish Covenanters and their view of Christ's headship and of the divine right of presbytery. I think because that is the conflict that is, you know, that is the crucial thing to understand throughout this history, I think. So first, let's look at the Stuart dynasty and their divine right of kings. And if you think, you know, this idea of the divine right of kings, where does it come from? It really doesn't come from the West, from, you know, the Judeo-Christian West, because it's just contrary to Christianity in general. And especially the Roman Catholic Church was not fond of the divine right of kings. So it didn't come from there. Where it came from is, you know, way back when you think of early Mesopotamian cultures and things like that, where you had your emperor or your king, when he died, there was a view that he was God. You know, when he died, he became a god and became part of your, you know, group of gods and stuff. And so, but there was one guy, and I don't know how to say his name, but I'll give it a shot. Shulgi of Ur. It's probably not right, but it's close enough. He's long dead, so it doesn't matter. But he took it a step further, and he said, I'm not going to be God when I die. I'm God right now, living, breathing, human king. I'm God right now. And that kind of developed that and stuff. So you have, you know, through history, you sort of have that idea of kings and being deities and things. Well, the Stuarts, who would have, you know, are in Scotland or in the West, are kind of, you know, under the Roman Catholic Church. Somehow they get a hold of this idea, and they're not saying they're God, but they're saying we are the agent of God. We, the divine right of kings says, God has put me in place as king, and there is nothing on earth, no law, no constitution, no popular opinion, nothing that limits my power. I can do whatever I want. And that's kind of the divine right of kings. And I think Mary, Queen of Scots, held to that view, but her son James is probably most known for that. And I have some quotes. They're listed there, 2A, 2B, and 2C. These all come from, James wrote a book called The True Law of Free Monarchies. He wrote it in 1598, before he took the crown of England. But I just want to read these and just realize how extreme a view this is. The state of monarchy is a supreme thing on earth. As to dispute what God may do is blasphemy, so is it treason in subjects to dispute what a king may do. Okay, so that he's putting, saying, when you question God, that's blasphemy. When you question a king, that's treason. You know, he's putting that on the same level. Number 2B there, if there's outlines and quotes there on the back if you want. Number 2B says, a good king will frame his actions according to the law, yet he is not bound thereto, but of his own good will. So he's saying, you know, hey, if you're a nice guy and care about justice and peace and mercy and stuff, yeah, you'll rule according to the law and do all that and be a good king. But you don't have to. That's just up to your own goodwill. You know, that's what he's saying. Number 2C, he says, first, it is a sure axiom of theology that evil should not be done, that good may come of it. The wickedness, therefore, of a king can never make them that are ordained to be judged by him to become his judges. I grant, indeed, a wicked king is sent by God for a curse to his people and a plague for their sins. So he's saying, no matter what happens, the people under a king never have the right to rebel against the king, no matter how bad it isn't. Because if it's bad, it means you sinned and God's punishing you. I mean, and you know, it's just amazing that he would think this, but he certainly did. And it didn't just apply to politics and government and things like that. It applied to the church as well. You know, they certainly understood that if you control the church, you control the people. And so they didn't want to just be the king and head in civil matters. They wanted to be the king and head in church matters. And, you know, that explains James really did not like Presbyterianism, and he was trying to get back to prelacy, which is the hierarchy of bishops and archbishops that he appoints. And you know, if you appoint a bishop or appoint an archbishop that's loyal to you and grateful to you for appointing them, they're going to go along with you much more than, you know, the Presbyterian model, which is individual congregations with elders and, you know, that's sort of independent of your authority. So you can understand why James pushed prelacy, pushed Episcopalianism so much, and his sons as well. I want to recount one story. It happened. So James becomes king over the whole unified Great Britain, right? And so he's leaving Scotland and going down to England to sort of, you know, kind of be promoted to that as king in London. And in England at the time, the English Puritans are getting more and more influential. And they're very similar to Scotch Presbyterian and things. And so they hear, okay, we're getting this new king. You know, we've had to deal with the Tudors and you know, King Henry and Bloody Mary and all those people. But now, you know, we're getting this king from Scotland, and he grew up in Presbyterian Scotland. He had a Presbyterian tutor. This is good news for us as English Puritans, because we like Presbyterianism. So they approach James and they say, here, we have some requests we'd like you to think about, and there are changes to the Church of England, one of which is saying, let's make Church of England Presbyterian like Scotland is. And they're expecting him to be positive about it. And his first response to them apparently was, no bishop, no king, that quick. Meaning, if you take the bishop out of it and take his authority away, I don't have any authority. If I can't control the church, I can't control the nation, I think is what he's saying. And then later in that dialogue, he says, if you aim at a presbytery, it agrees as well with monarchy as God and the devil. Okay, so he was very much not in favor of that, and so that was kind of a surprise to them. But you can see James is adamantly opposed to Presbyterianism, adamantly opposed to anything that gets in his way of being this kind of ultimate, all-encompassing, powerful monarch. Okay, his son Charles learned it well from his dad. One thing that Charles did, so this is Charles I, the one that's executed, but at one point he had established in Scotland that every four times a year, every church in Scotland, and remember, everybody in Scotland has to go to church, so, you know, everybody is in these churches. So four times a year, from the pulpit, an edict is read, and one of the parts of that edict basically says that anybody who opposes the king will be eternally damned. Okay, so he had that read four times a year in all the churches in Scotland, saying any opposition to me as king is equivalent to being, you know, there's no way you can go to heaven. So just extreme, extreme divine right of kings view. And quote number 5 there, if you want to read it from J.D. Douglas to sort of sum it up, he says, this ill-fated theory of the divine right of kings was to lead Mary, Queen of Scots, and Charles I to execution, cost James VII his throne, and spell the doom of the Stuart dynasty. Because, you know, and we'll see that later. So that's the divine right of kings side, and you see how extreme that is. And then I want to also look at the covenanter side, the Scottish Church's side, the Reformed Church of Scotland side. And I put a bunch of quotes in there, and then I tried to practice this and realized we're not going to look at the quotes. Nancy? Yes. Yeah. And he's King James VI and King James I, but that's kind of pointless to know that. So I gave you a bunch of quotes there, but we're only going to read really one. And I read it last week. It's Andrew Melville's quote when he's interacting with King James. But I just think it sums up the covenanter position so well, really the Scottish church position well. Remember, this is a face-to-face interaction where he's grabbing the sleeve of the king. This isn't a letter or something. So Andrew Melville, speaking to James in 1596, says, "Sire, there are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is King James, the head of this commonwealth, and there is Christ Jesus, the king of the church, whose subject James VI is, and of whose kingdom he is not a king, nor a lord, nor a head, but a member. We will yield to you your power, your place, and give you all obedience. But again, I say, you are not the head of the church. You cannot give us that eternal life which we seek for even in this world, and you cannot deprive us of it. Permit us then freely to meet in the name of Christ and to attend to the interests of their church of which you are a member. Sire, when ye was in your swaddling clothes, Christ reigned freely in this land. His ministers and servants did then freely in his name what they ought to do. And now, when ye are come to the kingdom, will you take it upon you to make encroachments?" Okay, so we read that last week, but I just think that sense of saying there's two kingdoms, it's such a bold statement to King James, knowing King James' philosophy now. So the other quotes there were for George Buchanan, who was the tutor of King James, remember, and he wrote that book for King James, which later King James burnt, so apparently not a good tutor-pupil relationship. There's a quote from Alexander Henderson, who was the primary author of the National Covenant. There's other quotes there, one from George Gillespie and so forth. So, you know, feel free to read those later, but we just don't have time to read those. I think you'll find that those sort of reinforce Melville's quote. Let me read this quote number 11 from J.D. Douglas that's sort of summarizing the Presbyterian view. He says, "We find it so frequently in the mouths of the Covenanters, the firm opposition of the Reformed Church of Scotland to two principles. Number one, the authority of the civil power in spiritual matters. And number two, the prelatic superiority of one minister over others." So he's saying, one thing they always opposed was involvement of the king in any way as a power in the church. And number two, any sense of a hierarchy of bishops and archbishops. Those are the two things the Covenanters always opposed. And he said, "This opposition consistently maintained to this day involves the necessary corollary that a thoroughgoing Presbyterian church, or any holding similar tenets, can never be completely relied upon by civil rulers who wish to use it as a mere engine of state for their political ends." Okay, so that's hopefully, you know, you understand that you have the controversy of the divine right of kings and the covenanters on the other side. And that controversy between, you know, it's really a controversy of the role of church and state. And that, you know, has been an issue all through the history of Christianity. And just to sort of point that out, J.D. Douglas, this book I've read, I didn't bring it today, but it's called The Light in the North, and it's one volume of an 8-volume series that's a history of Christianity, so 2,000 years, and it's J.D. Douglas is just the contributing author to the whole volume. So you have an 8-volume thing that says we're going to cover the whole world, all 2,000 years of Christianity, and you think, okay, how am I going to divide that up into 8 volumes? How would you do that? And F.F. Bruce assigns one entire volume to the Scottish Covenanters. And if you think about the period of time that covered, the small geographical area that covered, that just doesn't make sense. Why would he do that? And F.F. Bruce, this editor, writes the foreword to J.D. Douglas's book. And really, I think it's really helpful. It's quote number 12. It's kind of long, but I think you'll see why he devoted so much of an entire volume to this one little controversy in the history of all Christianity. So here he goes, quote number 12. "At first blush, the inclusion of a whole volume on the Scottish Covenanters in a series covering 2,000 years of Christian history may be put down to an excess of provincialism on someone's part. But the inclusion of this volume is due to something more than an exaggerated estimate of the importance of 17th century Scotland in the ongoing story of the church in the world. The story of the Scottish Covenanters, limited as it is in space and times, brings out in sharp outline a crucial issue which the Christian church has had to face from its earliest days and which is as acute today as ever it was. The issue is that of the relation between church and state. And then going forward in his quote, "There are still times when it must be emphasized that the civil ruler as such, even when he is a Christian, has no authority in church councils beyond that of the humblest church member. On the other hand, the obedience which a Christian man or the Christian community owes to the civil ruler, even when the ruler is a Christian, is never absolute. There are times when it may not merely be a Christian right, but a Christian duty to disobey the civil ruler. When his claims clash with the law of God, the Christian will say with the apostles, 'We must obey God rather than men.' Were men so conscious of their Christian right and duty as the covenanters were confronted by men so blindly insistent on imposing their own will as the stewards, the resultant conflict revealed the issues involved in exceptional clarity." Okay, so you see what he's saying? He's saying the reason I devoted an entire volume is because this relationship of church and state and how that works is such a big issue, and he feels like this controversy in all the history of Christianity best clarified that and you know, showed it out, and so that's why he did it. So anyways, that's sort of just sort of taking a deeper dive into this controversy, but let's get back to the timeline, the historical timeline. So I'm sorry you can't see that, but what this shows is it sort of shows Oliver Cromwell, and then it will be Charles II, James II, and then William and Mary, and it talks about that. But this is sort of an overview from Cromwell's time to the end of the persecution, which we'll cover. So I want to sort of talk about when Cromwell was over it, how that Cromwell's time ended and how Charles II was restored. And then we'll do an overview of the time of persecution. And then next week will be totally devoted just to kind of looking at that time of persecution in more detail. But so today is more of an overview of it. But let's go ahead and get started. So if you recall, Scotland is angry with England because they didn't keep their promise in the Solemn League and Covenant. They killed Charles I and they promised they wouldn't. And so Scotland doesn't want to have England rule over them or something. So they go off to Charles II, who is Charles' son, who's been exiled. You know, his dad's been executed. He's run away. He's on the mainland, sort of exiled out there. So Scotland says, we're going to go to Charles II and negotiate with him and say, if you meet the terms of our negotiation, we will crown you king and we will fight for you and help you take back Great Britain. Okay, so you think, why would they, you know, if they had so much trouble with Charles I, why would they do this with Charles II? It's because of what England, you know, they were so frustrated with England and Cromwell and things like that. So they send a delegation out to Charles II, who's this young man, and the terms that they say is basically, we will make you our king and we will fight for you if you swear to our covenants, the national covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, and you promise to preserve Presbyterianism and preserve the Reformation in Scotland. And let me read, this is quote number 13, but this is right from Charles II's coronation oath. So when you're crowned, you take a coronation oath. This is the oath or a piece of it that he had to take in order to take the crown. It says, "I, Charles, do assert and declare by my solemn oath in the presence of Almighty God, the searcher of hearts, my allowance and approbation of the national covenant and of the Solemn League and Covenant, and faithfully oblige myself to prosecute the ends thereof in my station and calling, and fully establishing Presbyterian government, and that I shall observe these in my own practice and family, and shall never make opposition to any of these or endeavor any changes thereof." Okay, so that's, you can't get more clear than that. He's saying, I will become your king, and I promise to, you know, sign the covenants. I promise to keep Presbyterianism, to preserve it, and never oppose it. And I'll even be Presbyterian in my own family. You know, that's what he's swearing to. Well, that forcing him to do that was sort of a bad idea. Everybody sort of knew that it was not done with with the right motivation. He wasn't, it was almost like he was crossing his fingers in a way to do it. This picture, it's hard to see, but it's a comic that was written back then, but it shows sort of the Scottish nation pushing Charles to the grindstone, forcing him to sign the covenants in order to take it. And so Let me read quote number 14 from J.D. Douglas. He says, "An odd stipulation was included in his recognition by the Scots. This involved the acceptance of both covenants and the swearing of an oath to establish Presbyterianism in all his dominions. The first Charles, so Charles I, had preferred to die rather than sign the covenant, on which condition the Scottish army would have come to his aid in England. No trace of any such fervent religious feeling characterized his son. Charles II was prepared to swallow the covenant at a gulp to give himself the chance of possessing a crown which he never wore." Okay, so he was, while Charles I was a very religious man, you know, just the wrong type, you know, but he was stubborn, he was unwilling, he was principled, he would not give in, he would rather die than do that. His son Charles II is much more sort of, you know, pragmatic and says, "I'll do whatever I have to do to take power." There was a man, so the Scottish delegation had gone to work out those terms with him, and one of those men was Alexander Joffrey, who was one of the Scottish commissioners, and this is quote 15, but he's reflecting back on that time later in life. And so being again sent there to negotiate with Charles for that same business, "We did sinfully both entangle and engage the nation and ourselves and that poor young prince to whom we were sent, making him sign and swear a covenant which we knew from clear and demonstrable reasons that he hated in his heart. Yet, finding that upon these terms only he could be admitted to rule over us, all other means having then failed him, he sinfully complied with what we most sinfully pressed upon him, where, I must confess to my apprehension, our sin was more than his." Okay, so he's saying it was wrong of us to do that. And actually, this is the first real big division in the Church of Scotland. The people who wanted to go to Charles II and forced him to do this were called the Resolutioners. And there was a group of people who said, "No, don't." And they were the protesters. And you had an act, you know, it really divided the church. And that's really the first serious division in the Church of Scotland that lasted for a while. They had their own, you know, synods and things like that after that point. So anyways, there's division in Scotland over this, but anyways, they do, you know, they come to this agreement, they crown Charles II as king, they bring him back to Scotland, and then raise an army, and they go to fight the English army, which is now being led by Oliver Cromwell. Well, Cromwell, who's an exceptional military leader, just wipes them out, just destroys them, and Charles II flees again in utter poverty and ruin, Cromwell, now he's mad with Scotland, and so he sort of leaves his army in Scotland to be an occupational force to ensure no more revolts, and that lasts almost 10 years, I think. You know, even though during that time with that occupation army there was peace, Cromwell didn't really mess with the Scottish Church very much. He let him be. You know, in retrospect, it was a pretty decent time for the Scottish Church, the Scottish nation. They hated it, and they hated Cromwell, and they called Cromwell a usurper and a trampler upon the liberties of the Church of Scotland. And it's just funny that they didn't realize how good they had it compared to where it would go. But anyways, you know, you can imagine you wouldn't be thrilled with an occupation army kind of in your nation to ensure you don't revolt again, things like that. So Cromwell does that for about 10 years, and he's ruling over all Great Britain as Lord Protector. That was his name. I think, you know, he really was sort of a tyrant or ruled all by himself. And they always come up with these nice, pleasant names, Lord Protector, you know. But so Cromwell, though, he dies in 1658, and he's succeeded by his son Richard, who's nothing like his dad. He's not a leader. He quickly loses power. There's a power struggle between English Parliament and the English army. And finally, all of Great Britain just says, enough, we want our king back. And so they bring Charles II back in. England does, you know, England's the big, big nation of the Great Britain. And they bring him back, crown him in London about 10 years after they tried to crown him in Scotland. So now all of a sudden Charles is back on the throne of England, back on the throne of Great Britain. And it's just kind of funny how it does that. I think you can see this slide enough. Just say on the top left is sort of the Church of Scotland, which is Presbyterian, and then on the side is a picture of Charles and James and what they did to that to kind of split it into the Episcopal Church of Scotland and then this dissenting body, the Covenanters. So the slide was meant to sort of, you know, be a thousand words, but sorry that you can't read exactly. But let me kind of talk about it a little more. So Charles II comes into power, and like his father, like his grandfather, King James, he's all about unifying his country, unifying Great Britain. All he wants it all to be episcopal. He wants it all to be, you know, bishops and archbishops that he appoints so that he can control everything. And so England is like that already, but Scotland is not. And so he quickly changes things in Scotland, there, like through oaths of allegiance and stuff that acknowledged his power and supremacy. And then in 1649, there was an act called the Abjuration Act, and it did several things, one of which it made the covenants, you know, the national covenant, the psalm, it made those illegal, and they were burned throughout Scotland, kind of symbolically to say they were done with this. The other thing it did is it said all this time over the past several decades where, you know, Scotland has been Presbyterian and all these new ministers have been ordained by presbyteries, all those ministers now have to go back to these newly appointed bishops and be confirmed by them. Okay, so they're not legitimate ministers anymore unless they're confirmed by the bishop. And that was a big deal. And you have about 1,000 ministers in Scotland at the time. A third of them refused to do that, or maybe couldn't. You know, maybe they had something, but a third of them refuse, and it's called the Great Ejection. They're kicked out of the Church of Scotland. And the thing to think about is there aren't multiple denominations in Scotland. So when you're kicked out of the Church of Scotland, you're kicked out of the church. You know, capital C church kind of thing. And ministers got their pay from, you know, the Church of Scotland. They lived in a house like a manse or a, what do we call, parsonage, you know, all that. And so they lose their income, they lose their house, they lose their congregation, they lose everything. It was a big deal to do that. But a third of the ministers did that sort of on principle. And so that's sort of that break. You have what remains in Church of Scotland is now fully blown Episcopalianism, but you have this large dissenting body, which are continue to be called the Covenanters. And let me think here real quick. So now, you know, Charles has done that. He's made the official Church of Scotland entirely Episcopalianism. He's done with that. But now he has to deal with this very large dissenting body of, you know, it's 300 ministers, and think of all the lay persons that would represent. Kind of there was a large body in Scotland that had sort of dissented from the Church of Scotland. So Charles and later his brother James deal with the Church of Scotland in this dissenting body in two ways: indulgences and persecution. And so indulgences don't think of Martin Luther and his indulgence, you know, that issue. The indulgences that we're talking about, whereas the king would say, okay, all you ministers that got ejected, we will let you come back into the church if you meet these particular terms. And there were 7 indulgences offered over the years, and they each had kind of different terms. But in general, they were saying, you have to still go get confirmed by the bishop. You have to promise that you'll never preach anything contrary to, you know, that would be considered treasonous to the king. You have to follow all the rules that we have. And they did that 7 times. And what's amazing is almost all 300 ministers went back in at one of those, you know, one indulgence would happen and 40 would go in. Another one would happen, 80 would go in. And you know, when I was reading about this, I thought, why? But I think you have to realize, again, to leave the Church of Scotland meant you left your income, you left your house, and most of these ministers were married and had families. And so that meant you have no income, you have no home. That was hard. And maybe the more important thing was you left your congregation. And when you left your congregation, when you're ejected, your congregation had 2 options. Either, you know, now all of a sudden the Church of Scotland has this huge personnel problem. They've lost a third of their ministers. So either you have a congregation that doesn't have a minister, and there's, you know, maybe another minister sort of becomes an itinerant minister and helps out, but that's sort of, they're being neglected as a congregation. Or the other thing, which is worse, is Church of Scotland goes up into the Northern Highlands of Scotland, which the northern part of Scotland, the Highlands had never been reformed. It was still Roman Catholic, still actually a lot of pagan areas. Even Roman Catholicism hadn't gone up there. And so they go through there, and it's a very poor area, and they just find all these sort of unemployed, idle, young teenage boys and young men and say, hey, come with us. You're going to be pastors. And they just round them up, bring them down, and install them in these churches. And And you can imagine that. They're not educated. They're inexperienced. They just have no business being a minister. And just, this is quote number 20, if you want to follow along, but a bishop who's in the Church of Scotland would be pro, you know, pro-Episcopalianism, all that. He, writing about these new ministers, says, "These were the worst preachers I ever heard. They were ignorant to a reproach, and many of them were openly vicious. They were the dregs and refuse of the northern part of Scotland." So that's a guy that is involved in, you know, that's not a Presbyterian covenanter guy talking. That is a bishop talking about them. So anyways, they put all these pastors in like that. And so imagine if you're a pastor in Scotland, a Reformed pastor, and you've left the church over principle, but now you see your congregation under one of these men, and it's hard. And so it wasn't a black and white decision. It was a lot of gray area. And maybe you can understand a little bit why so many of the ministers decided to go back in. But there were several ministers that didn't, and they would have just been the most principled, the most kind of anti-prelatic ministers. Okay, so that was the indulgences, and that really worked. If you have 300 ministers leave and almost all of them go back in, that was successful on the part of Charles II and his brother James. The other way they worked was persecution, and persecution, you know, from the persecutor's perspective, I don't think ever works. They always think it will, but it never does. But that was the other means they used. And so, you know, all the pastors that had left, been ejected and stayed out of the church, they can't meet in the church buildings and things like that anymore. But what they do is they start holding, you know, either small services in people's homes, or more commonly, bigger meetings outside. And we call those conventicles. So you have people gather from all around into this outdoor area, and you have what they call a conventicle, and an outdoor meeting. And so Charles is aware of these things happening, and so he starts to pass laws to fight against those. The first one, or one of the early ones, was called the Bishop's Dragnet, and it made it a law that if you preached at one of these conventicles, or if you preached ever without authorization from a bishop, so again, you can't, if you're not confirmed by a bishop, you're not allowed to preach. If you do, that's just an act of treason, and punishable as such. And then what it also did was it started fining lay people. So, you know, you're required to go to your parish. The pastor at your parish is keeping track if you're there or not. If you're not, he's going to report you to the soldiers. They're going to come fine you, or find you, and then, you know, charge you a fine for not being at the parish church. You know, so it was, that's why it's called the Bishop's Dragnet, because they kind of come in and find all the dissenters and bring them back in, kind of thing. So that was early on, you know, not that severe persecution. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse. In 1664, the Court of High Commission was established by Charles, and there was no appeal from its sentence. It moved around and just would try somebody and make a decision there and act, and it really seemed like the Inquisition. To quote from J.G. Voss, "At this time, the Court of High Commission could inflict any punishment short of death. Many were fined and imprisoned, others banished, and some sold as slaves. It appears that of all the persons tried by the Court of High Commission, not a single one was acquitted or escaped without suffering some penalty." So, meaning they went and did all these supposedly just trials on people, and never did they find someone not guilty. They were always guilty, and they were always punished. And it just becomes more, you know, again, over the years, they pass stricter and stricter laws. And then quote number 24 from J.G. Voss, this is a little longer, but I think this summarizes this kind of continuing increase in the persecution. "In the summer of 1670, the Parliament passed the Second Act against conventicles. All previous measures had failed to stop the seditious meetings, and this act, which others passed at the same time, provided legislation intended to suppress utterly all religious meetings not held in parish churches, and to exterminate those who attended and supported such meetings. Every person was required to give evidence on oath concerning conventicles and those who attended them. The penalty for refusal to testify was fine, imprisonment, or banishment. The oath could be administered at any time and by any public official. This legislation, while intended to suppress conventicles, failed to do so. The effect was rather to force such meetings to be held in greater secrecy and in remoter places than had been done before. One of the most diabolical features of this legislation was that it attempted to force persons to give evidence against their most intimate friends and nearest relatives. It is also worthy of note that by this legislation, death and confiscation of goods was a penalty provided for conducting or preaching at a conventicle. Rewards were offered for the capture of conventicle preachers. Okay, so it's getting more and more severe. But like he says, even so, it didn't stop the conventicles. And actually in 1677 and 78, the conventicles kind of reached their height. There's estimate that one conventicle had 7,600 people in attendance. Okay, 7,600, that's a big group. And you can imagine, you know, having to do that far enough away so that you wouldn't be apprehended by the soldiers and things. In 1685, up to 1685, death was administered of people who preached at a conventicle. Up at 1685, a law was passed that provided for the death penalty for anybody who even attended a conventicle. It got to the point where if there was a fact that established you were there, you were killed, but it was also if there was presumption that you were there and there was no need to prove it, you were killed. No longer did you have trials with this Court of High Commission. It was just soldiers going out, and based on their decision, they could execute people, without any trial, without any legal system. It just got more and more severe, so much so that from 1685 to 1688, 3 years, that period of time is called the killing times. So that's just a quick overview of it. A couple other considerations about the time of persecution. The Covenanters weren't entirely passive. You know, they didn't just sort of let all this happen to them. They fought it in a couple ways. One way is they did these what we'll call like public protests or testimonies, and they'd sort of write a paper and they'd go to the public marketplace and hammer it somewhere where it was seen, or they read it out loud in the market, and these were long papers that sort of said, this is why the king is not a legitimate ruler, this is why we're refusing to obey him, you know, stating their reasons for what they were doing. There was the Rutherglen testimony, the Queensberry paper, the Sanguahard Declaration, and a couple others, again, that were these kind of protests against it. So they were publicly protesting against Charles, which would just make him even more angry. They also, at times, would actually have armed conflict with the soldiers of Charles. Not a lot of them, but there was the Pentland Uprising, which is about 1,000 Covenanters. And they fought they fought Charles' forces in a battle and lost in Rolling Green. After the Rutherglen testimony was published, about 200 Covenanters fought against the army at Drumclog and beat them there, but then in a later battle were defeated and stuff. So there was some armed conflict, and a lot of historians think that was wrong of the Covenanters, saying they shouldn't have, you never do that. My opinion is they were justified in that because they argued that the king was no longer their legitimate ruler, and so they had a right to fight against him. They in 1679 they even assassinated Archbishop Sharp, who was sort of the key person. We'll learn about him next week, but he was this guy who was a very severe persecutor, and he was assassinated. Things like that. So. I just want to say it's not like they were just taken. They fought back at times, but I think that was kind of a small piece of it. But it was there. And just to summarize on the extent of the persecution, I think, throughout this period, you had Covenanters that were banished to America, who were imprisoned, who were killed in skirmishes, executed after this trial of the High Commission, or simply slaughtered without any process of law. During that time, about 7,000 Covenanters fled from Scotland sort of voluntarily, but also during the time, about 18,000 people were either killed, imprisoned, or banished. So 18,000, in our American terms, that doesn't seem like that big a number, but remember, Scotland is 1 million people. It's the size of the Fresno metro area. That's 18,000 people. So that's how you have to think. That's a big percentage, and it was a drastic thing. So that, again, next week we'll spend looking at some of the stories of those martyrs and learning more about that, but that's a very high overview. When that, again, in 1688, that ended, and the way it ended was, again, you have King James the First. He has a son, Charles the First, who's executed. They eventually bring Charles the Second, his son, back. When Charles the Second dies, his son, James the Second, they weren't very creative on names, his son, James the Second, becomes king, and he only rules for 3 years. And while Charles the Second was sort of the secular king, could, you know, was willing to sign the covenant if it got him as king, do whatever he wanted, his brother James was a devout Catholic, and he's quoted as saying to a Roman Catholic priest that James would either convert England or die a martyr, and he had rather die the next day and convert it than reign 20 years piously and happily and not affected. Okay, so James doesn't, you know, he's not just saying I want Episcopalianism. He says I want to go back to Roman Catholicism. And while at first they weren't that concerned about it because they figured, well, he'll die, and then his sister, who's married to a Protestant up in the Netherlands, will come and we'll go back to where we were. Problem is then James has a son, and now they know, okay, when James dies, no longer is it his sister who succeeds to the throne, it's his son. And so there's all of Great Britain eventually says, we're done with James. We don't want to go back to Roman Catholicism. William and Mary, Mary is his sister, William and Mary of Orange are in the Netherlands. They come to England and say, with kind of a force to take over, ready to fight James for the throne. James sees the writing on the wall and backs away, and there is no real conflict. It's called the Bloodless Revolution. And so the nation of Great Britain throws off James and has Mary, who is his sister, but really William of Orange, who's a foreign monarch, come and take over. And William and Mary are definitely not, you know, we'll go into in the future about what their views were religiously, but they were totally were totally against persecution, and so the persecution just stopped when they came into power. And so that was good for the Covenanters. And just the one thing we had talked about, this idea of, was it right for the Covenanters to fight back against Charles and his persecution? And it's interesting that the whole time the Covenanters are saying, we fight back because they're illegitimate rulers. We're allowed to revolt against the illegitimate ruler. That was sort of their argument. And then you have here later, all of Great Britain all of a sudden says, we're going to get rid of James and bring in someone else. And the argument they used to justify that was exactly the same argument the Covenanters had stressed all along. And so to read from quote number 28 there, J.D. Douglas says, nothing vindicates the position of the Covenanters through the persecuting years so much as the fact that their consistent arguments for renouncing the Stuart kings, which had led to the sacrifice of several thousand Presbyterian lives, became now the reason offered to the world for the righteousness of the invasion of Britain by a foreign liberator. And then J.G. Voss, in quote number 29, saying a similar thing, the right of revolution, the right of a nation to decide when its rulers have forfeited the right to rule, on which the Covenanters had repeatedly insisted, was now being claimed and exercised, not merely by a few thousand persecuted persons, but by the estates of Scotland, representing the whole nation in convention assembled. Okay.